This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Less, a novel, written by Andrew Sean Greer, read by Robert Petkoff.
For Daniel Handler. Less at first. From where I sit, the story of Arthur Less is not so bad. Look at him, seated primly on the hotel lobby's plush round sofa, blue suit and white shirt, legs knee-crossed so that one polished loafer hangs free of its heel, the pose of a young man. His slim shadow is, in fact, still that of his younger self, but at nearly 50 he is like those bronze statues in public parks that, despite one lucky knee rubbed raw by schoolchildren, discolor beautifully until they match the trees. So has Arthur Less, once pink and gold with youth, faded, like the sofa he sits on, tapping one finger on his knee and staring at the grandfather clock. The long patrician nose perennially burned by the sun, even in cloudy New York October. The washed-out blonde hair, too long on the top, too short on the sides. Portrait of his grandfather. Those same watery blue eyes. Listen, you might hear anxiety ticking, ticking, ticking away as he stares at that clock, which, unfortunately, is not ticking itself. It stopped 15 years ago. Arthur Less is not aware of this. He still believes, at his ripe age, that escorts for literary events arrive on time and bellboys reliably wind the lobby clocks. He wears no watch. His faith is fast. It is mere coincidence that the clock stopped at 6:30, almost exactly the hour when he is to be taken to tonight's event. The poor man does not know it, but the time is already 6:45. As he waits, around and around the room circles a young woman in a brown wool dress, a species of tweed hummingbird, pollinating first this group of tourists and then that one. She dips her face into a cluster of chairs, asking a particular question, and then, dissatisfied with the answer, darts away to find another. Less does not notice her as she makes her rounds. He is too focused on the broken clock. The young woman goes up to the lobby clerk, then to the elevator, startling a group of ladies overdressed for the theater. Up and down Less's loose shoe goes. If he paid attention, perhaps he would have heard the woman's eager question, which explains why, though she asks everyone else in the lobby, she never asks it of him.
Excuse me, but are you Miss Arthur?
The problem, which will not be solved in this lobby, is that the escort believes Arthur Less to be a woman. In her defense, she has read only one novel of his in an electronic form that lacked a photo, and found the female narrator so compelling, so persuasive, that she was certain only a woman could have written it. She assumed the name to be one of those American gender curiosities. She is Japanese. This is, for Arthur Less, a rare rave review. Little good this does him at the moment, sitting on the round sofa from whose conical center emerges an oiled palm. For it is now 6:50. Arthur Less has been here for 3 days. He is in New York to interview famous science fiction author H.H.H. Mandern on stage to celebrate the launch of H.H.H. Mandern's new novel. In it, he revives his wildly popular Holmesian robot, Peabody. In the world of books, this is front page news, and a great deal of money is jangling behind the scenes. Money in the voice that called Less out of the blue and asked if he was familiar with the work of H.H.H. Mandern and if he might be available for an interview. Money in the messages from the publicist instructing Less what questions were absolutely off the table for H.H.H. Mandern, his wife, his daughter, his poorly reviewed poetry collection. Money in the choice of venue. The advertisements plastered all over the village. Money in the inflatable Peabody battling the wind outside the theater. Money even in the hotel Arthur has been placed in, where he was shown a pile of complimentary apples he can feel free to take any time, day or night. You're welcome. In a world where most people read one book a year, there is a lot of money hoping that this is the book and that this night will be the glorious kickoff. and they are depending on Arthur Less. And still, dutifully, he watches the stopped clock. He does not see the escort standing woefully beside him. He does not see her adjust her scarf, then exit the lobby through the washing machine of its revolving doors. Look at the thinning hair at the crown of his head, the rapid blink of his eyes. Look at his boyish faith. Once, in his 20s, a poet he had been talking with extinguished her cigarette in a potted plant and said, "You're like a person without skin." A poet had said this. One who made her living, flaying herself alive in public, had said that he, tall and young and hopeful Arthur Less, was without skin. But it was true. "You need to get an edge," his old rival Carlos constantly told him in the old days. But Less had not known what that meant. To be mean? No. It meant to be protected, armored against the world, but can one get an edge any more than one can get a sense of humor? Or do you fake it, the way a humorless businessman memorizes jokes and is considered a riot, leaving parties before he runs out of material? Whatever it is, Les never learned it. By his 40s, all he has managed to grow is a gentle sense of himself, akin to the transparent carapace of a soft-shelled crab. A mediocre review or careless slight can no longer harm him. But heartbreak, real, true heartbreak, can pierce his thin hide and bring out the same shade of blood as ever. How can so many things become a bore by middle age, philosophy, radicalism, and other fast foods, but heartbreak keeps its sting? Perhaps because he finds fresh sources for it. Even foolish old fears have never been vanquished, only avoided. Telephone calls, frenetically dialing like a man decoding a bomb. Taxicabs, fumbling the tip and leaping out as from a hostage situation. And talking to attractive men or celebrities at parties, still mentally rehearsing his opening lines, only to realize they are saying their goodbyes. He still has these fears, but the passage of time solved them for him. Texting and email saved him from phones forever. Credit card machines appeared in taxis. A missed opportunity could contact you online. But heartbreak. How can you avoid it except to renounce love entirely? In the end, that is the only solution Arthur Less could find. Perhaps it explains why he gave 9 years to a certain young man. I have neglected to mention that he has on his lap a Russian cosmonaut's helmet. But now, a bit of luck. From the world outside the lobby, a chime rings out. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, causing Arthur Less to pop out of his seat. Look at him, staring at his betrayer, the clock, then running to the front desk and asking at last, the essential temporal question.
"I don't understand how you could think I was a woman."
"You are such a talented writer, Mr. Less. You tricked me. And what are you carrying?"
"This? The bookstore asked me to..."
"I loved Dark Matter. There is a part that reminded me of Kawabata."
"He's one of my favorites. The old capital, Kyoto."
"I am from Kyoto, Mr. Less."
"Really? I'll be there in a few months."
"Mr. Less, we are having a problem."
This conversation takes place as the woman in the brown wool dress leads him down a theater hallway. It is decorated with a lone prop tree, the kind the hero hides behind in comedies. The rest is all brick painted glossy black. Less and his escort have run from the hotel to the event space, and he can already feel the sweat turning his crisp white shirt into a transparency. Why him? Why did they ask Arthur Less? A minor author whose greatest fame was a youthful association with the Russian River School of writers and artists, an author too old to be fresh and too young to be rediscovered, one who never sits next to anyone on a plane who has heard of his books. Well, Less knows why. It is no mystery. A calculation was made. What literary writer would agree to prepare for an interview and yet not be paid. It had to be someone terribly desperate. How many other writers of his acquaintance said, no chance? How far down the list did they go before someone said, what about Arthur Less? He is indeed a desperate man. From behind the wall, he can hear the crowd chanting something. Surely the name H.H.H. Mandern. In the past month, Less has privately gorged on H.H.H. Mandern's works, those space operettas, which at first appalled him with their tin-ear language and laughable stock characters, and then drew him in with their talent for invention, surely greater than his own. Less's new novel, A Serious Investigation of the Human Soul, seems like a minor planet compared with the constellations invented by this man. And yet, what is there to ask him? What does one ever ask an author except, how? And the answer, as Less well knows, is obvious. Beats me. The escort is chattering about the theater capacity, the pre-orders, the book tour, the money, the money, the money. She mentions that H.H.H. Mandern seems to have come down with food poisoning.
You see,
the escort says, and a black door opens onto a bright, clean room where deli meats fan across a folding table. Beside it stands a white-haired lady in shawls, and below her, H.H.H. Mandern vomiting into a bucket. The lady turns to Arthur and scans the space helmet.
Who the hell are you?
New York. The first stop on a trip around the world. An accident, really, of Less trying to find his way out of a sticky situation. He's quite proud he has managed to do so. It was a wedding invitation. Arthur Less has, for the past decade and a half, remained a bachelor. This came after a long period of living with the older poet Robert Brownburn, a tunnel of love he entered at 21 and exited, blinking in the sunlight, in his 30s. Where was he? Somewhere in there he lost the first phase of youth, like the first phase of a rocket. It had fallen, depleted, behind him. And here was the second, and last. He swore he would not give it to anyone. He would enjoy it. He would enjoy it alone. But how to live alone and yet not be alone? It was solved for him by the most surprising person, his one-time rival, Carlos. If asked about Carlos, Less always calls him one of my oldest friends. The date of their first encounter can be pinpointed precisely. Memorial Day, 1987. Less can even remember what each of them wore. He, a green Speedo. Carlos, the same, in bright banana. Each with a white wine spritzer in hand like a pistol, eyeing the other from across the deck. A song was playing. Whitney Houston wanting to dance with somebody. Shadow of a sequoia falling between them. With somebody who loved her. Oh, to have a time machine and a video camera. To capture thin, pink-gold Arthur Less and brawny, nut-brown Carlos Palou in their youth when your narrator was only a child. But who needs a camera? Surely for each of them, that scene replays itself whenever the other's name is mentioned. Memorial Day, Spritzer, Sequoia, somebody. And each smiles and says the other is one of my oldest friends. When, of course, they hated each other on sight. Let us take that time machine after all, but to a destination almost 20 years later. Let us land ourselves in mid-2000s San Francisco, a house in the hills on Saturn Street. One of those creatures on stilts. A glass wall revealing a never-used grand piano, and a crowd of mostly men celebrating one of a dozen 40th birthday parties that year. Among them, a thicker Carlos, whose longtime lover left him real estate when he died, and who turned those few lots into a property empire, including far-flung holdings in Vietnam, Thailand, even some ridiculous resort Less heard about in India. Carlos, same dignified profile, but no trace anymore of that muscled young man in a banana Speedo. It was an easy walk for Arthur Less from his little shack on the Vulcan steps where he now lived alone. A party. Why not? He chose a Lessian costume, jeans and a cowboy shirt, only slightly wrong, and made his way south along the hillside toward the house. Meanwhile, imagine Carlos enthroned in a peacock chair and holding court. Beside him, 25 years old, in black jeans, t-shirt, and round tortoiseshell glasses with dark curly hair, his son.
"My son,"
I recall Carlos telling everyone when the boy first appeared, then barely in his teens. But he was not his son. He was an orphaned nephew shipped off to his next of kin in San Francisco. How do I describe him? Big-eyed, with brown, sun-streaked hair and a truculent demeanor in those days, he refused to eat vegetables or to call Carlos anything but Carlos. His name was Federico, Mexican mother, but everybody called him Freddy. At the party, Freddy stared out the window where the fog erased downtown. These days he ate vegetables but still called his legal father Carlos. In his suit he was painfully thin, with a concave chest, and while lacking youth's verve, Freddy had all of youth's passions. One could sit back with a bag of popcorn and watch the romances and comedies of his mind projected onto his face, and the lenses of his tortoiseshell glasses swirled with his thoughts like the iridescent membranes of soap bubbles. Freddy turned at the sound of his name. It was a woman in a white silk suit and amber beads with a cool Diana Ross demeanor.
"Freddy, honey, I heard you were back in school."
What was he studying to be? She asked gently. Proud smile. A high school English teacher. This caused her face to flower.
"God, that's nice to hear. I never see young people going into teaching.
To be honest, I think it's mostly that I don't like people my age." She picked the olive from her martini.
"That'll be hard on your love life."
"I suppose. But I don't really have a love life," Freddy said, taking a long gulp from his champagne, finishing it.
"We just have to find you the right man. You know, my son, Tom..."
From beside them,
"He's actually a poet."
Carlos, appearing with a listing glass of white wine. The woman, courtesy requires introductions, Caroline Dennis in software, Freddy would come to know her very well, yipped. Freddy eyed her carefully and gave a shy smile. "I'm a terrible poet. Carlos is just remembering that's what I wanted to be when I was a kid."
"Which was last year," Carlos said, smiling.
Freddy stood silently. His dark curls quivered with whatever shook his mind. Mrs. Dennis gave a sequined laugh. She said she loved poetry. She had always been into Bukowski and that bag.
"You like Bukowski?" Freddy asked.
"Oh, no," said Carlos.
"I'm sorry, Caroline, but I think he's even worse than I am." Mrs. Dennis's chest flushed. Carlos drew her attention to a painting done by an old pal of the Russian River School, and Freddy, unable to swallow even the vegetables of small talk, stalked to the bar for another champagne. Arthur Less at the front door, one of those low walls with a white door concealing the house that drops down the hill behind it. And what will people say?
"Oh, you look well. I heard about you and Robert. Who is keeping the house?"
How could he know that 9 years lay beyond that door?
"Hello, Arthur.
What is that you're wearing?"
"Carlos."
20 years later, and still that day, in that room, old rivals at battle. Beside him, a young man with curly hair and glasses, standing at attention.
"Arthur, you remember my son, Freddy?"
It was so easy. Freddy found Carlos's house intolerable, and so often, after a long Friday teaching and hitting a happy hour with a few of his college friends, would show up at Les's, tipsy and eager to crawl into bed for the weekend. The next day would be Les nursing a hungover Freddy with coffee and old movies until Les kicked him out on Monday morning. This happened once a month or so when they first began, but grew into a habit until Les found himself disappointed when one Friday evening the doorbell never rang. How strange to wake up in his warm white sheets, the sunlight through the trumpet vine, and sense something missing. He told Freddy the next time he saw him that he should not drink so much or recite such terrible poetry. And here was a key to his house. Freddy said nothing but pocketed the key and used it whenever he liked and never returned it. An outsider would say, "That's all fine, but the trick is not to fall in love." They would have both laughed at that. Freddy Palu and Arthur Less? Freddy was as uninterested in romance as a young person should be. He had his books and his teaching and his friends and his life as a single man. Old, easy Arthur asked nothing. Freddy also suspected that it drove his father nuts that he was sleeping with Carlos's old nemesis, and Freddy was still young enough to take pleasure in torturing his foster parent. It never occurred to him that Carlos might be relieved to have the boy off his hands. As for Les, Freddy was not even his type. Arthur Less had always fallen for older men. They were the real danger. Some kid who couldn't even name the Beatles? A diversion. A pastime. A hobby. Les, of course, had other more serious lovers in the years he saw Freddy. There was the history professor at UC Davis who would drive 2 hours to take Les to the theater. Bald, red-bearded, sparkling eyes and wit. It was a pleasure for a while to be a grown-up with another grown-up, to share a phase of life, early 40s, and laugh about their fear of 50. At the theater, Les looked over and saw Howard's profile lit by the stage and thought, "Here is a good companion. Here is a good choice." Could he have loved Howard? Very possibly. But the sex was awkward. Too specific. "Pinch that, okay? Now touch there. No. Higher. No, higher. No, higher." And felt like an audition for a chorus line. Howard was nice, however, and he could cook. He brought ingredients over and made sauerkraut soup so spicy it made Les a little high. He held Les's hand a lot and smiled at him. So Les waited it out for 6 months to see if the sex would change, but it didn't, and he never said anything about it, so I suppose he knew it wasn't love after all. There were more. Many, many more. There was the Chinese banker who played the violin and made fun noises in bed, but who kissed like he'd only seen it in movies. There was the Colombian bartender whose charm was undeniable, but whose English was impossible. "I want to wait on your hand and on your foot." Les's Spanish was even worse. There was the Long Island architect who slept in flannel pajamas and a cap as in a silent movie. There was the florist who insisted on sex outdoors, leading to a doctor's visit during which Les had to ask for both an STD test and a remedy for poison oak. There were the nerds who assumed Les followed every news item about the tech industry, but who felt no obligation to follow literature. There were the politicians sizing him up as for a suit fitting. There were the actors trying him on the red carpet. There were the photographers getting him in the right lighting. They might have done, many of them. So many people will do. But once you've actually been in love, you can't live with "will do." It's worse than living with yourself. No surprise that again and again, Les returned to dreamy, simple, lusty, bookish, harmless, youthful Freddy. They went on in this way for 9 years. And then, one autumn day, it ended. Freddy had changed, of course, from a 25-year-old to a man in his mid-30s. A high school teacher in blue short-sleeved button-ups and black ties, whom Les jokingly called Mr. Palu, often raising his hand as if to be called on in class. Mr. Palu had kept his curls, but his glasses were now red plastic. He could no longer fit his old slim clothes. He had filled out from that skinny youngster into a grown man, with shoulders and a chest and a softness just beginning on his belly. He no longer stumbled drunk up Les's stairs and recited bad poetry every weekend. But one weekend he did. It was a friend's wedding, and he did show up, tipsy and red-faced, leaning into Les as he staggered, laughing, into his mudroom. A night when he clung to Les, radiating heat. And a morning when, sighing, Freddie announced that he was seeing someone who wanted him to be monogamous. He had promised to be about a month earlier, and he thought it was about time he stayed true to his promise. Freddie lay on his stomach, resting his head on Les's arm, the scratch of his stubble. On the side table, his red glasses magnified a set of cufflinks. Les asked, "Does he know about me?" Freddie lifted his head. "Know what about you?" "This." He gestured to their naked bodies. Freddie met his gaze directly.
"I can't come around here anymore."
"I understand."
"It would be fun. It has been fun, but you know I can't."
"I understand." Freddie seemed about to say something more, then stopped himself. He was silent, but his gaze was that of someone memorizing a photograph. What did he see there? He turned from Les and reached for his glasses. "You should kiss me like it's goodbye."
"Mr. Pelu," Les said, "it's not really goodbye."
Freddie put on his red glasses, and in each aquarium a little blue fish swam.
"You want me to stay here with you forever?"
A bit of sun came through the trumpet vine. It checkered one bare leg. Les looked at his lover, and perhaps a series of images flashed through his mind. A tuxedo jacket, a Paris hotel room, a rooftop party. Or perhaps what appeared was just the snow blindness of panic and loss, a ... message relayed from his brain that he chose to ignore. Les leaned down and gave Freddie a long kiss. Then he pulled away and said,
"I can tell you used my cologne."
The glasses, which had amplified the young man's determination, now magnified his already wide pupils. They darted back and forth across Les's face as in the act of reading. He seemed to be gathering up all his strength to smile, which, at last, he did.
"Was that your best goodbye kiss?" he said.
Then, a few months later, the wedding invitation in the mail. "Request your presence at the marriage of Federico Pelu and Thomas Dennis." How awkward. He could, under no circumstances, accept, when everyone knew he was Freddie's old paramour. There would be chuckles and raised eyebrows, and, while normally Les wouldn't have cared, it was just too much to imagine the smile on Carlos's face. The smile of pity. Les had already run into Carlos at a Christmas benefit, a fire trap of pine branches, and he had pulled Les aside and thanked him for being so gracious in letting Freddie go.
"Arthur, you know my son was never right for you."
Yet Les could not simply decline the invitation. To sit at home while all the old gang gathered up in Sonoma to drink Carlos's money? Well, they would cackle about him all the same. Sad young Arthur Les had become sad old Arthur Les. Stories would be brought out of mothballs for ridicule. New ones would be tested as well. The thought was unbearable. He could under no circumstances decline. Tricky, tricky, this life. Along with the wedding invitation came a letter politely reminding him of an offer to teach at an obscure university in Berlin, along with the meager remittance and the meager time remaining for an answer. Les sat at his desk, staring at the offer. The rearing stallion on the letterhead seemed to be erect. From the open window came the song of roofers hammering and the smell of molten tar. Then he opened a drawer and pulled out a pile of other letters, other invitations, unanswered. More were hidden deep within his computer. Still more lay buried beneath a pile of phone messages. Les sat there, with the window rattling from the workers' din, and considered them. A teaching post, a conference, a writing retreat, a travel article, and so on. And, like those Sicilian nuns who once a year appear behind a lifted curtain singing so that their families can gaze upon them, in his little study, in his little house, for Arthur Les, a curtain lifted upon a singular idea.
"My apologies," he wrote on the RSVP, "but I will be out of the country. My love to Freddie and Tom."
He would accept them all. What a ramshackle itinerary he has nailed together. First, this interview with H.H.H. Mandern. This gets him plane fare to New York City with 2 days before the event to enjoy the city, aflame with autumn. And there is at least one free dinner, the writer's delight, with his agent, who surely has word from his publisher. Les's latest novel has been living with his publisher for over a month, as any modern couples live together before a marriage, but surely his publisher will pop the question any day now. There will be champagne, there will be money. Second, a conference in Mexico City. It is the kind of event that for years Les has refused, a symposium on Robert's work. He and Robert split up a decade and a half ago, but once Robert became ill and unable to travel, the directors of literary festivals began to contact Les, not as a novelist in his own right, rather as a kind of witness, a Civil War widow, as Les thinks of it. These festivals want one last glimpse of the famous Russian River School of writers and artists, a 1970s bohemian world long receded over the horizon, and they will accept a reflected one. But Les has always refused. Not because it would diminish his own reputation. This is impossible, since Les feels almost subterranean in stature. But because it seems parasitic to make money off what was really Robert's world. And this time, even the money isn't enough. It's not enough by half. But it neatly kills the 5 days between New York and the prize ceremony in Turin. Third, Turin. Les is dubious. He is supposedly up for a prestigioso award for a book recently translated into Italian. Which book? It took some searching to discover it is Dark Matter. A pang of love and regret. The name of an old amour on your cruise ship's passenger list.
Yes, we are happy to provide airfare from Mexico City to Turin. Your driver will await.
As glamorous a sentence as Les has ever read. He wonders who funds such European excesses, considers they are perhaps laundering ill-gotten gains, and finds, printed at the bottom of the invitation, the name of an Italian soap conglomerate. Laundering indeed. But it gets him to Europe. Fourth, the Winterzeitung at the Liberated University of Berlin. A 5-week course on a subject of Mr. Les's choosing. The letter is in German. The university is under the impression Arthur Les is fluent in German, and Arthur Les's publisher, who recommended him, is also under this impression. So is Arthur Les. With God's happiness, he writes back, I accept the pedestal of power, and sends it off with a flush of pleasure. Fifth, a sojourn across Morocco, his single indulgence on the itinerary. He would be tacking on to another birthday celebration for someone he has never met named Zora, who has planned an expedition from Marrakesh into the Sahara Desert and from thence northward to Fez. His friend Louis insisted. They were looking to fill one spot on the trip. How perfect! The wine would be copious, the conversation scintillating, and the amenities deluxe. How could he say no? The answer, as always, money, money, money. Lewis relayed the cost, all-inclusive, and though the amount was staggering, Les checked twice to be sure it was not in Moroccan dirhams, he was, as always, already too much in love. Bedouin music was already playing in his ears. Camels were already grunting in the darkness. He was already standing up from embroidered pillows and walking out into the desert night, champagne in hand, to let the flowery Sahara warm his toes, as above him the Milky Way glowed with his birthday candles. For it was somewhere in the Sahara that Arthur Les would turn 50. He swore he would not be alone. Memories of his 40th, wandering the broad avenues of Las Vegas, still came to him in worser moments. He would not be alone. Sixth, to India. Who gave him this peculiar idea? Carlos, of all unlikely people. It was at the very Christmas party where his old rival first discouraged Les in one field, my son was never right for you, and then encouraged him in another.
You know, there's a retreat center very close to a resort I'm fixing up. Friends of mine. Beautiful place on a hill above the Arabian Sea. It would be a wonderful place for you to write.
India. Perhaps he could rest at last. He could polish the final draft of his novel, the one whose acceptance his agent will surely be celebrating in New York with that champagne. When was monsoon season again? And finally, to Japan. He was, improbable as it seems, at a writer's poker game in San Francisco when it fell into his lap. Needless to say, these were heterosexual writers. Even in his green eyeshade, Les was not a convincing player. The first game, he lost every hand. But he was a good sport. It was during the third game, when Les began to think he could not bear another minute of the cigarette smoke and grunting and warm Jamaican beer, when one man looked up and said his wife was pissed at all his travel. He had to stay home and pass on an article, and could anyone go to Kyoto in his stead?
I can,
Les shrieked. The poker faces all looked up, and Les was reminded of volunteering for the school play in junior high. The same expressions on the faces of the football players. He cleared his throat and lowered his voice.
I can.
A piece for an in-flight magazine about traditional Kaiseki cuisine. He hoped he would not be too early for the cherry blossoms. From there, he will head back to San Francisco and return once again to his house on the Vulcan Steps. Paid for, almost all of it, by festivals, prize committees, universities, residency programs, and media conglomerates. The rest, he has found, he can cover with free airline points that, neglected over the decades, have multiplied into a digital fortune, as in a sorcerer's magic chest. After prepaying for the Morocco extravagance, he has just enough in his savings to cover necessities, providing he practices the puritanical thrift drilled into him by his mother. No clothing purchases, no nights on the town, and, God help him, no medical emergencies. But what could possibly go wrong? Arthur Less, encircling the globe. It feels cosmonautical in nature. The morning he left San Francisco, 2 days before the event with H.H.H. Mandern, Arthur Less marveled that he would not be returning as he had his entire life from the East, but from the mysterious West. And during this odyssey, he was certain he would not think about Freddie Pelu at all. New York is a city of 8 million people, approximately 7 million of whom will be furious when they hear you were in town and didn't meet them for an expensive dinner, 5 million furious you didn't visit their new baby, 3 million furious you didn't see their new show, 1 million furious you didn't call for sex, but only 5 actually available to meet you. It is completely reasonable to call none of them. You could instead sneak off to a terrible, treacly Broadway show that you will never admit you paid $200 to see. This is what Les does on his first night, eating a hot dog dinner to make up for the extravagance. You cannot call it a guilty pleasure when the lights go down and the curtain goes up, when the adolescent heart begins to beat along with the orchestra, not when you feel no guilt. And he feels none. He feels only the shiver of delight when there is nobody around to judge you. It is a bad musical, but like a bad lay, a bad musical can still do its job perfectly well. By the end, Arthur Less is in tears, sobbing in his seat, and he thinks he has been sobbing quietly until the lights come up and the woman seated beside him turns and says,
"Honey, I don't know what happened in your life, but I am so, so sorry,"
and gives him a lilac-scented embrace. "Nothing happened to me," he wants to say to her. "Nothing happened to me. I'm just a homosexual at a Broadway show." Next morning, the coffee maker in his hotel room is a hungry little mollusk, snapping open its jaws to devour pods and subsequently secreting coffee into a mug. The instructions on care and feeding are clear, and yet somehow Les manages to produce on the first go nothing but steam, and on the second, a melted version of the pod itself. A sigh from Les. It is an autumn New York morning, and therefore glorious.
It is his first day of his long journey, the day before the interview, and his clothes are still clean and neat, socks still paired, blue suit unwrinkled, toothpaste still American and not some strange foreign flavor. Bright lemon New York light flashing off the skyscrapers onto the quilted aluminum sides of food carts, and from there onto Arthur Less himself. Even the mean, delighted look from the lady who would not hold the elevator, the humor-free girl at the coffee shop, the tourists standing stock still on busy Fifth Avenue, the revved-up accosting hawkers, "Mister, you like comedy? Everybody likes comedy." The toothache sensation of jackhammers in concrete. None of it can dull the day. Here is a shop that sells only zippers. Here are 20 of them. The Zipper District. What a glorious city. "What are you going to wear?" the bookstore employee asks when Les stops by to say hello. He has walked 20 wonderful blocks to get here. "What am I going to wear? Oh, just my blue suit." The employee, in pencil skirt, sweater, and glasses, a burlesque librarian, laughs and laughs. Her mirth settles into a smile.
"No, but seriously," she says, "what are you going to wear?"
"It's a great suit." "What do you mean?"
"Well, it's H.H.H. Mandarin, and it's almost Halloween. I found a NASA jumpsuit. Janice is coming as the Queen of Mars."
I was under the impression he wanted to be taken seriously.
"But it's H.H.H. Mandarin. Halloween. We have to dress up."
She does not know how carefully he packed his luggage. It is a clown car of contradictory possessions. Cashmere sweaters, yet light linen trousers. Thermal underwear, yet suntan lotion. A tie, yet a Speedo. His workout set of rubber bands, and so on. What shoes do you pack for the university and the beach? What sunglasses for northern European gloom and South Asian sun? He would be passing through Halloween, Dia de los Muertos, Festa de San Martino, Nikolaustag, Christmas, New Year's, Eid al-Maulid, Vasant Panchami, and Hinamatsuri. The hats alone could fill a shop window. And then there is the suit. There is no Arthur Less without the suit. Bought on a whim in that brief era of caprice 3 years ago when he threw caution and money to the wind and flew to Ho Chi Minh City to visit a friend on a work trip, searching for air conditioning in that humid, moped-plagued city, found himself in a tailor shop ordering a suit. Drunk on car exhaust and sugarcane, he made a series of rash decisions, gave his home address, and by the next morning had forgotten all about it. 2 weeks later, a package arrived in San Francisco. Perplexed, he opened it and pulled out a medium blue suit lined in fuchsia and sewn with his initials, APL. A rosewater smell from the box summoned instantly a dictatorial woman with a tight bun hectoring him with questions. The cut, the buttons, the pockets, the collar, but most of all, the blue. Chosen in haste from a wall of fabrics. Not an ordinary blue. Peacock? Lapis? Nothing gets close. Medium, but vivid. Moderately lustrous. Definitely bold. Somewhere between ultramarine and cyanide salts, between Vishnu and Amon, Israel and Greece, the logos of Pepsi and Ford. In a word, bright. He loved whatever self had chosen it and after that wore it constantly. Even Freddy approved. "You look like someone famous." And he does. Finally, at his advanced age, he has struck the right note. He looks good. And he looks like himself. Without it, somehow he does not. Without the suit, there is no Arthur Less. But apparently the suit is not enough. Now, with a schedule crammed with lunches and dinners, he will have to find... what? A Star Trek uniform? He wanders down from the bookstore to his old neighborhood where he lived after college, and it gives him a chance to reminisce about the old West Village. All gone now, the soul food restaurant that used to hold Les's extra key underneath the coconut cake, the string of fetish stores whose window displays of rubberized equipment gave young Les terrors, the lesbian bars Les used to frequent on the theory he would have a better chance with the men there, the seedy bar where a friend once bought what he thought was cocaine and emerged from the bathroom announcing he had just snorted Smarties, the piano bars stalked one summer by what the New York Post inaccurately called the karaoke killer. Gone. Replaced by prettier things. Beautiful shops of things made of gold, and lovely little chandelier restaurants that served only hamburgers, and shoes on display as if at a museum. Sometimes it seems only Arthur Les remembers how downright filthy this place used to be. From behind him, "Arthur? Arthur Les?" He turns around. "Arthur Les, I can't believe it! Here I was just talking about you." He has embraced the man before he can fully take in whom he is embracing, instead finding himself immersed in flannel, and over his shoulder a sad, big-eyed young man with dreadlocks looks on. The man releases him and starts to talk about what an amazing coincidence this is, and all the while Les is thinking, "Who the hell is this?" A jolly, round, bald man with a neat gray beard in plaid flannel and an orange scarf standing grinning outside a grocery store used to be a bank on 8th Avenue. In a panic, Les's mind races to put this man before a series of backgrounds. Blue sky and beach, tall tree and river, lobster and wine glass, disco ball and drugs, bed sheets and sunrise. But nothing is coming to mind. "I can't believe it," the man says, not releasing his grip on Les's shoulder. "Arlo was just telling me about his breakup, and I was saying, you know, give it time. It seems impossible now, but give it time. Sometimes it takes years and years. And then I saw you, Arthur, and I pointed down the street. I said, 'Look, there's the man who broke my heart.' I thought I'd never recover. I'd never want to see his face again or hear his name. And look, there he is out of nowhere, and I have no rancor. How long has it been? 6 years, Arthur? No rancor at all." Les stands and studies him. The lines on his face, like origami that has been unfolded and smoothed down with your hand, the little freckles on the forehead, the white fuzz from his ears to his crown, the coppery eyes flashing with anything but rancor. Who the hell is this old man? "You see, Arlo," the man says to the young man, "nothing. No feelings at all. You just get over all of them. Arlo, will you take a picture?" And Les finds himself embracing this man again, this chubby stranger, and smiling for a picture that young Arlo moves to take until the man begins instructing him. "Take it again. No, take it from over there. Hold the camera higher. No, higher. No, higher."
"Howard," Les says to his old lover, smiling, "you look wonderful."
"And so do you, Arthur. Of course, we didn't know how young we were, did we? Look at both of us now. Old men."
Les steps back, startled.
"Well, good to see you," Howard says, shaking his head and repeating, "Isn't that lovely? Arthur Les, right here on 8th Avenue. Good to see you, Arthur. You take care. We've got to run."
A kiss on the cheek is misaimed and lands on the history professor's mouth. He smells of rye bread. Brief flash to 6 years ago, seeing his silhouette in the theater and thinking, "Here is a good companion. A man he almost stayed with, almost loved, and now he does not even recognize him on the street. Either Les is an asshole, or the heart is a capricious thing. It is not impossible both are true." A wave to poor Arlo, to whom none of this is a comfort. The two are about to cross the street when Howard stops, turns back, and with a bright expression says,
"Oh, you were a friend of Carlos Pelu, weren't you? Isn't it a small world? Maybe I'll see you at the wedding."
Arthur Les did not publish until he was in his 30s. By then, he had lived with the famous poet Robert Brownburn for years in a small house, a shack, they always called it, halfway up a steep residential stairway in San Francisco. The Vulcan Steps, they're called, curving from Levant Street at the top, down between Monterey pines, ferns, ivy, and bottle brush trees, to a brick landing with a view east to downtown. Bougainvillea bloomed on their porch like a discarded prom dress. The shack was only four rooms, one of them expressly Robert's, but they painted the walls white and hung up paintings Robert had gotten from friends, one of them of an almost identifiable Les, nude, on a rock, and planted a seedling trumpet vine below the bedroom window. It took 5 years for Les to take Robert's advice and write, just labored short stories at first, and then, almost at the end of their lives together, a novel. Calypso, a retelling of the Calypso myth from the Odyssey, with a World War II soldier washed ashore in the South Pacific and brought back to life by a local man who falls in love with him and must help him find a way back to his world and to his wife back home.
Arthur, this book,
Robert said, taking off his glasses for effect.
It's an honor to be in love with you.
It was a moderate success. None other than Richard Champion deigned to review it in the pages of the New York Times. Robert read it first and then passed it to Les, smiling, his glasses on his forehead for his poet's second pair of eyes. He said it was a good review. But every author can taste the poison another has slipped into the punch, and Champion ended by calling the author himself a magniloquent spoonie. Les stared at those words like a child taking a test. Magniloquent sounded like praise, but was not. But a spoonie? What the hell was a spoonie? It's like a code, Les said. Is he sending messages to the enemy? He was.
Arthur, Robert said, holding his hand. He's just calling you a faggot.
Yet, like those impossible beetles that survive years in the dunes, living only on desert rains, his novel somehow, over the years, kept selling. It sold in England and France and Italy. Les wrote a second novel, The Counterglow, which got less attention, and a third, Dark Matter, which the head of Cormorant Publishing pushed hard, giving it an enormous publicity budget, sending him to over a dozen cities. At the launch in Chicago, he stood off stage and listened to his introduction. Please welcome the magniloquent author of the critically acclaimed Calypso, and heard the whimpering applause of perhaps 15-20 people in the auditorium, that dreadful harbinger, like the dark rain spots one notices on a sidewalk before the storm, and he was brought back to his high school reunion. The organizers had convinced him to do a reading, billed on the mailed invitation as An Evening with Arthur Les. No one in high school had ever wanted an evening with Arthur Les, but he took them at their word. He showed up at low, squat Delmarva High School, even squatter than in memory, thinking of how far he had come. And I will let you guess how many alumni came to An Evening with Arthur Les. By the publication of Dark Matter, he and Robert had parted, and since then, Les has had to live on desert rains alone. He did get the shack when Robert decamped to Sonoma, mortgage paid off after Robert's Pulitzer. The rest he has patched together, that crazy quilt of a writer's life. Warm enough, though it never quite covers the toes. But this next book, this is the one. It is called Swift, To Whom the Race Does Not Go. A peripatetic novel. A man on a walking tour of San Francisco and of his past, returning home after a series of blows and disappointments. All you do is write gay Ulysses, said Freddie. A wistful, poignant novel of a man's hard life. Of broke, gay middle age. And today, at dinner, surely over champagne, Les will get the good news. In his hotel room, he puts on the blue suit, freshly dry cleaned, and smiles before the mirror. Nobody came to An Evening with Arthur Les. Freddie once joked that Les's agent was his great romance. Yes, Peter Hunt knows Les intimately. He handles the struggles and fits and joys that no one else witnesses. And yet, about Peter Hunt, Les knows almost nothing at all. He cannot even recall where he is from. Minnesota? Is he married? How many clients does he have? Les has no